Well, I'm not sure anyone's heading offshore in a boat to broadcast to islanders illegally, as happened in Britain in the 1960s, but pirate radio is alive and well in Canada. That's according to the authors of a new book called Islands of Resistance, Pirate Radio in Canada. Andrea Langlois and Marianne van der Zon are two of them. They'll be launching the book tonight in Nanaimo and tomorrow in Victoria. But before they do, they agreed to speak to me for a conversation to be broadcast over the mainstream radio waves.
Good morning, Gordon.
Now, I think a lot of people might hear the term pirate radio and think of ships off the British coast back in the 1960s. Andrea, is pirate radio still alive today?
Well, we have 279 pages right in front of us here that show that from coast to coast, from Halifax to Victoria and the Gulf Islands, pirate radio is very much alive in Canada.
And what forms does it take? I guess it looks from the book like it takes a lot of different forms.
Yeah, it's quite different in Canada than other places. Ron Sikalski, who co-edited this book with us, he also did a book about pirate radio in the U.S. And what we see in Canada is it takes broader forms. For example, we have a lot of artists in Canada, a lot of sound artists that use pirate radio as a way to do really innovative things with sound, you know, from treasure walks to big choral things within large spaces. But we also have people using pirate radio in protests.
These meetings are a desperate attempt to go on with business as usual at the WTO.
And we also have small communities, mostly rurally, using pirate radio as a form of community radio. How are you doing today, Rose?
I'm doing fabulous today.
So it can mean a lot of things. Marianne, what does it mean to you? What are some of the types of pirate radio that you've focused on?
Well, I guess for me personally, probably the largest thing is the capacity to build community. And that applies whether it's in the context of a smaller station in a rural area. It also applies in the context of sound art, using transmitters as an instrument.
It does have all sorts of uses, and I want to ask you about some of them in particular. What about activists? How is it used by activists?
Well, we have one good example in the book that we write about. In 2003 in Montreal, there were some activists organizing for a WTO ministerial meeting. And as part of 5 days of protest, they set up a multitude of media tools, from daily newspapers to video, but they also had an online and on air through broadcasting radio station that they used to highlight the issues that people were struggling against and to highlight what was going on in the movement. More recently, the same thing happened in Vancouver for the Olympic protest. There was a pirate radio set up at Vivo, an artist-run studio. It was unfortunately shut down after one day, but the hopes were also to use that space to create dialogue about the social issues surrounding the Olympics.
Why is there a need for it? Now, as opposed to, I think it certainly made a lot of sense in decades past. I'm not saying it doesn't make sense now, but why do people continue to do it when there is so much interconnectivity online?
There is so much interconnectivity, but I think that our media spaces and in society are becoming increasingly enclosed. So using the airwaves to speak and to learn media skills or to do art is one way of reclaiming them and actually pushing back and saying we should actually continue to have open spaces for community. Community radio stations, for example, are a great place for people to get involved, but there's often a lot of training, a lot of barriers. You have to go through CRTC regulations and applications. And with the pirate radio station, you can be up for a day and down for a day.
What about First Nations? There's some interesting examples of First Nations in this country using pirate radio.
Yeah, one of the most amazing chapters in the book is written by Charles Mosteller, an independent journalist out east. And he worked with some other activists in Montreal to go up to Barrier Lake, which is a northern community. To set up a pirate radio station. And the community there was excited because they were having difficulties engaging youth. They have a language that they want to be able to preserve. And the radio station became a way for them to do that. So there became a lot of engagement. So First Nations people, they believe that in sovereignty, and their sovereignty rights include the airwaves. And so using the pirate radio to have a community station to engage youth. And the chapter in the book, you know, it tells this story of people wanting to do radio bingo, people discussing whether to play country music or hip hop, and the youth getting extremely engaged and speaking their native tongue. And so in a storytelling culture, language and auditory forms of media are extremely important. And in a small community, pirate radio just can allow you to do that quite easily and cheaply.
I think it's important, too, to remember that sometimes we need to push boundaries in society, and it's certainly the Indigenous community in Canada that is in a lot of ways the precursor to pirate radio. It's in the Indigenous communities that had their own stations, and from that then evolved campus community stations.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to ask you about that and the CRTC and whether you think it needs to be pushed further. I mean, are there still too many limitations?
I think so. The process is both extremely lengthy and extremely expensive. It also tends to favor commercial corporate interests. And so what you find, even right now, I'm at a conference, the National Campus Community Radio Association conference, and what we find is a lot of campus community radio stations that are wanting to set up their own stations, and the advice that they're getting from Industry Canada and CRTC representatives is to stream online. But if you're streaming online, then again, it comes to this issue of access. You are catering to a very specific group of people. You're catering to a group of people that are computer savvy and used to working with computers. And while those of us who use computers regularly, that applies to, I think it's easy to forget that there's still large portions of our population who don't have that kind of access and don't have those skill sets.
Well, Andrea and Marion, it's good to get a peek into this from both of you. Thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you very much, Gregor.
Thank you.